I don't want no oil spoiling my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a-creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes!
Good morning, Toledo, and good afternoon, Columbus, and hello to those of you on the internet, listening wherever and whenever you are. My name is Joe DeMar, and I'm here with my fantabulous co-host,
Rebecca Wood.
Yes, and together, Rebecca and I are going to bring you an hour of incredible radio called For a Green Future.
For our friend R2-T2.
yes, steeping nicely there. For a Green Future is a show where we talk about ecology and the environment, and we talk about them in the ways that they affect you, your wealth, your health, your happiness, the wealth and health and happiness of your friends and families and coworkers and fish and fowl and mammals and arthropods and annelids and pretty much everybody and everything, because all of us are together here on this wonderful planet we call Earth. And we have a wonderful show for you today. And before we go any farther, I want to say last week was our Thanksgiving episode with Philip Yenyo, which was really great. It was also, forgot to mention, our 250th episode.
Woohoo!
Yeah. So we've been around for a while. We've been doing this for a fair bit here. So you think we'd be better at it by now. But I think we're better than when we started, though, I would say that.
Yeah, probably so, yeah.
Yeah. So, but we do the best we can, and, you know, we have fun. That's also important. And we have a fun episode for you today. We're going to chat for another 10 minutes or so, and then we're going to hear from our guest, Verena Miramir, who is an author who is visiting from Austria, and we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the differences between Austria and the U.S. in terms of environmental stuff. So kind of a fun interview, a little different for us, but then we'll hear from our patrons and sponsors, and then we'll hear from Rebecca. And Rebecca, what do you have for us today?
We'll be talking about wood bison.
Wood bison. All right, cool. And then it'll be ecological news, and we have a ton of ecological news this week, so plenty to learn about, plenty to listen to, and that's it. That will be our show. So you won't be able to call in, of course, because this is still pre-recorded, although hopefully next week we'll be back in studio. That's what I'm aiming for, is because I love doing live radio. The unfortunate thing is that because of the scheduling, I'm going to have to create two episodes in 1 week, one pre-recorded, and then we'll be able to do the next one live.
Yeah, we don't know if we're up to that, but we're going to try.
Yeah, we're going to try, yeah. So the big news this week in terms of environmental stuff, and on the video version, I'll put this up on the screen, but a graph came out called Global 2-Meter Surface Temperature Anomalies Graph, 1940 to 2023, versus the 1850 to 1900 IPCC baseline. In other words, they took the pre-industrial temperatures and averaged them out. And then they put all the actual temperature measurements on a graph with that. And I got to say, folks, if you just look at this graph, it kind of looks like game over. I mean, you might have heard about this. We crossed the 2 degree centigrade line. And I'm physically looking at this graph, and almost all of 2023 is like an order of magnitude above the rest of the temperatures from 1940 to 2022. But the temperatures this past couple weeks just shot like almost vertical. It was like a almost straight line right up over the 2 degree centigrade mark, which is the mark that the climate scientists have told us are going to be, that's where society's going to start breaking down, because they've done the math that you just won't be able to grow food or ship products it's not good. So, you know, everything we do is kind of in the shadow of that, that number. And it's kind of depressing. I went to the Bowling Green City Council last night, and there were a bunch of people there who were promoting something called they were from the Citizens Climate Lobby, and they're a great bunch of people. I mean, they're some of the really coolest people around, have been pulled into this organization. And what they're fighting for is a climate fee, which I'm not exactly sure about how this works. And if you know and you want to correct me, please feel free to email at joe@joedemarforagreenfuture.org.
It's like they say, punishable by a fine means legal for a price.
Right. That what they want to do is they want to charge a fee on the oil and the fossil fuel companies up front as they take the carbon out of the ground. And then, like, once a year around Christmas time, they will send that fee out to everybody in America in the form of a check. Now, taking the fee out means they're going to increase prices, so gas will be more expensive for people. But then, you know, the fee will supposedly, theoretically, the fees could, the dividend is going to be the same for every person in America. So Bill Gates would get the same, you know, $50 that you get, which the thing about it to me, I've been kind of leery about it. I've been going over it in my head thinking, is this going to be net a positive thing? Or what I'm worried about is that if you have the oil industry or the fossil fuel industry sending people checks every year, how committed are they going to be to eliminating the fossil fuel industry?
Yeah.
You know, it's like it comes around Christmas time. You know, it's what we use to buy our presents every year. You know, do we really want to get rid of Exxon?
And the margins are getting, you know, they have everybody working. All the young people got 3 jobs and OnlyFans, you know, so that's going to make that's going to have a huge impact, whatever they get sent. You know,
yeah. Yeah. So, and one of the things that came out in the meeting last night, because about half a dozen people were urging the Bowling Green City Council to send a letter to our federal legislators supporting this carbon fee. One of the things that came out is that this is actually supported by the American Petroleum Institute, which is probably...
Which means they're afraid somebody's going to do something worse to them.
it's literally the most pro-fossil fuel organization in the world,
right?
Literally. The American Petroleum Institute is just, if you're looking at this carbon pollution, if you're looking at this graph and saying whoever did this to us must be evil, they would be the most evil. They would win. So, but... this doesn't relieve us of the responsibility of trying to do everything we can to lessen our own carbon footprint. also on that note, kind of another little depressing thing, Bowling Green this month started charging me the fee for having solar panels, the penalty for having solar panels on my house. Up till now, what they've been doing is, in my opinion, misappropriating funds and taking money – from other people in the municipal utility who paid extra to get what's called EcoSmart money. That is, so they paid extra to get their electricity from wind and solar. And so they were siphoning off a little bit of that and using that to pay my penalty. They didn't get rid of my penalty. They just took other people's money to pay it, so it didn't show up on my bill.
Okay.
So this month, right after the election, thank you very much, they decided to just to stop doing that and just start billing me and the other solar panel owners in Bowling Green directly, which I didn't want to be taking other people's money, but the main thing is there shouldn't be a penalty.
Yeah, of any sort for anyone.
Yeah, and so if you are somebody who is considering putting solar panels on your roof, do it now before these fossil fuel interests get to your municipality or whatever, and make sure that when you have the agreement, that your interconnection agreement, make sure that there's no penalty in there, and put in there that they can't add a penalty, because I put mine up. There was no penalty. As soon as I turned mine on, they said, "Oh, we got to start penalizing these people." So, and one thing I learned, as I said, I ran for Bowling Green mayor and lost 26% to 74%. But one of the things we learned was that by going door to door and talking to literally thousands of people, the vast, vast majority of them do not want to be penalizing solar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though they weren't ready to vote for me for mayor, they all agreed, like 90%+ agreed that charging people a penalty for putting solar on their roof is insane. So don't let that dissuade you from putting solar on your roof. And, get the car, get the electric car, get the plug-in hybrid, insulate your house, switch over to heat pumps. Basically, you got to do everything you can, folks, because our political leaders have bailed on us. They either they're outright hostile to trying to fix the carbon problem, or they're just sort of sitting back and letting whatever happens happen. So it's not good. But something that is good is the fact that, over these 250 episodes, we have had just amazing guests. We've had people literally on the front lines of protests. We've had some of the top scientists in the world in environmental fields on our show. But also, from time to time, we just get regular old ordinary people on our program. And that's kind of what we did this week. Verena is not a member of any kind of environmental group. She's just sort of she's an Austrian citizen, and so she just kind of has a view of that from that perspective. And so it was really nice to be able to interview her and talk about some of the differences between Austria and the U.S. And one thing that I noticed in interviewing her is, they've got some amazing things going compared to us, especially in terms of like public transportation, and you're going to hear about that. But she, even though compared to us they're doing great, she was not satisfied with that. You know what I mean?
Good for her.
Yeah, exactly. They're doing wonderful, but they're not done. They're not satisfied. They need more and they want more. And that's how you get more,
Exactly.
We're always being told, environmentalists, like whenever there's any kind of little bit of a crumb thrown to us, we're like, there, okay, now be happy. But, the places where people are making a huge difference and actually really dropping their carbon footprints and so forth, they're not satisfied. They don't accept the crumbs and say, okay, we did it. No, they...
Darn straight.
They're like, okay, good, now we need more. now change this policy and now change that policy. So.
Plus, her name means truth in Latin. I looked it up. I looked it up because Verena is the name of the First Lady of the American Confederacy, and I thought it was, thought it was just like a Southern name or something. But this is Southern antebellum people like to have fancy Roman sounding names, so it all hangs together.
Oh, Verena,
yeah,
huh? Interesting.
Verena, yeah.
Hmm. Well, all right then. Here's some,
Verena Davis.
Here's some. Well, this is Verena Marimer.
Right. Even well, if we got somebody who was dead on our show, that would be a real coup. But even if it wasn't environmental, but you know,
we'll work on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's our interview with Verena Marimer. Here's some truth from truth.
Definitely.
Okay. All right. Welcome to For a Green Future. Could you please tell us your name, what you do, and where you're from?
I'm Verena. I'm a writer, and I also have a freelance job. And I'm currently here in Bowling Green to visit some great friends like Joe DeMar, and also to do some research for short stories. And I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Our pleasure. So, Verena, you're visiting the United States and on your vacation this year. And one difference, we're talking about differences between Austria, Europe, and the U.S., is that 6 weeks of vacation is not at all unusual. Isn't that true?
Well, normally people have 5 weeks of vacation, but they could also do over shifts and then, you know, add up the free time they earned their vacations. But I'm a freelancer, so sometimes I work more, sometimes I work less, so you cannot completely add this up. But I think it's important that people would reduce their work time also for the climate, because we don't need to produce all that goods and to stress ourselves about work since we've become more productive in a way. So mm-hmm. I think that is...
Yeah. So 5 weeks is... at least, which is much more than the U.S. where after a year you get 2 weeks, and then after 10 years you get 3 weeks. Yeah, so that's great. So what prompted me to ask you to the interview this week was that we were talking about public transportation, and could you compare a little bit the public transit system in the U.S. versus Austria?
Well, just let me go back to the vacation thing once more. I think it's also a privilege having, you know, your own time and deciding on it. And I just want to say that I know that it's not for granted that everybody has this. And yeah, about the public transport system. Well, I was astonished that a city like Bowling Green, which has the council, has the university, until... few years ago or a year ago, maybe a couple of years, like when I was here the last time in 2020, there was no bus leaving Bowling Green. So you had a car, you were stuck here. And I like Bowling Green, but I don't like to be stuck in a place.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at a city like Bowling Green in Austria, you would expect that probably there is a railway going there, and you might have like one or two trains an hour leaving the city and coming back. Maybe the last train will be around 10, 11 p.m. If it's a city close to a major town like Vienna and Baden or so, you would have even night buses, but that's close to Vienna, that's not for granted. And sometimes we have this taxi. Also in some outskirts of cities, you would find on-call taxi services, where probably not the only one on the taxi, because there are more people waiting for the taxi. And that's a concept that exists very often in Eastern Europe or Western Asia. They call them Maschrutka, which comes from the German word Maschrute. It's a small car or van that brings a small number of people to a place, and sometimes they leave once they are full, sometimes they leave every half an hour, every 2 hours or so. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think the idea, just the idea that there could be like a train, like 10 or 15 or 20 trains a day running between someplace mm-hmm. like Bowling Green and Toledo, for Americans, that's kind of mind-blowing. That we yeah, and I assume there's like benches, and you know, these are fairly comfortable places to wait.
Yeah, and we don't have this kind of, you know, safety issues. Like, I personally don't feel threatened when I'm at the railway station. So, yeah, okay, there's one maybe a bit gritty station in Vienna, but it's like you just wait there. There are benches. There are, you know, plenty of people taking trains. Sometimes the trains are so crowded because now they invented the climate ticket.
Oh, yes. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a thing which I think it's pretty good. And it was, for that, I'm also kind of grateful for the Green Party because they made this possible. You can take trains in all over Austria for 1 year for 1,095 euros. Or if you're a senior citizen or you're a young person, it's 821. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a good thing. And since they invented it, many people take the train who probably wouldn't have taken the train before.
Yeah. In the U.S., it costs about $10,000 a year to maintain a car. So to be able to go literally almost anywhere in the country for an entire year for a little over... The euro and the dollar are fairly close, so it's a little over $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a huge boost to people's personal economies, yeah.
Well, maybe the problem would be first you need to build rail tracks and have the buses going. And I know Detroit, for example, they have buses, and I like that you can put your bike onto the bus because we are not allowed to do this. Like, either you take the bike or the bus. And that's the best practice example. But, yeah, the other thing that many people mention when talking about the climate ticket is that, oh, but then you would have people just traveling around for fun, going places, and it's also not good for the climate to take the train. It's better than nothing. But, well, I would say it's better than they take the car and go somewhere for fun, because that's what they would do if, you know.
Now, here in Ohio, unfortunately, we have a penalty on electric cars. $100 a year for a plug-in hybrid and $200 for all electric. Are electric cars encouraged in Austria?
Okay, so in Austria you get subsidies for electric transportation. So for a car it would be up to 5,000 euros. And I just looked it up for transportation bike. It's up to a cargo bike. It's up to 1,000 euros. But that also led to the problem that people are taking cars which are hybrid, and they are taking bigger cars because then they can afford it, which, you know.
Yeah.
It's a side effect.
Well, and bikes, you mentioned cargo bikes. Bikes are used much more, right, in Vienna and in Austria than they are here.
Yes, and... In Vienna, you don't necessarily need to be a daredevil when you use your bike. There are some roads I wouldn't recommend for beginners because we also have tramways, and it can be tricky with slippery, wet roads and rain and fog crossing rail tracks. Or there might be traffic, and sometimes you have a cycling lane, but then it stops and you have got a bit of road. But they are improving our cycling lanes, and mostly it's kind of fine. And still, when you look at the proportions, it's like, okay, on some roads there are 4 or 5 lanes for cars, and there is a thin, tiny cycling lane. And if you're trained, you might be able to pass somebody. But if you are not trained and not a routine cyclist, so if you have a cargo bike, you can never pass somebody, no matter how slow they go. Mm-hmm. And so that also leads to a bit of conflict. And I don't know if I ever told you this, but Viennese people, they are not famous for being the most friendly persons on earth. So sometimes you have fights between drivers and cyclists, or fights between cyclists, because the cycling lane is narrow. And yeah.
Mm. But at least you've got one. We
got them, yeah.
We don't have any here in Bowling Green.
So we said that, we sometimes say that's complaining on a high level. Yeah. I don't know how you translate that.
That yeah. sounds like a pretty good
okay.
translation. So care for the environment, though, kind of extends beyond just transportation in Austria, doesn't it? I mean, I understand there's actually parts of the Danube that are so clean that people swim in them in the summer. And it's hard to imagine doing that in the Maumee in Toledo. So.
I wouldn't swim in the Maumee, too. We do care about the environment, and most many people try to do. Many people are aware there is climate change. Some, though, find it exaggerated to take precautions. For example, we've got this endless discussion about just driving like with 100 kilometers an hour on the freeway instead of 130. I've seen on TV an interview with Marta Krumpek. She's from Last Generation. It's an environmentalist organization. And she said that, well, if we can't even do this, it's the most simple and the most stupid measure. And what is wrong with us if we don't even manage to do this? Like mm-hmm. telling people you can only drive 100 and it would save a lot of carbon dioxide from being emitted, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's about 65 miles an hour versus about 90 miles an hour, I think, doing the math in my head. So, yeah, 65 is fast enough to get most anywhere.
It is fast enough, and we are a small country. I think everybody is aware of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So. And we can also visit our neighboring countries with night jets and so on, or sometimes if we take the car, then we can calculate an hour more. But yeah, we also have a chancellor who said that Austria is a car country, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you also have a big section of Vienna where it's no cars, right?
We've got one parking lot there, but it's an island that stretches from the very west of the city to the very east. It's 21 kilometers long, so if you want to walk that, you could do it in one day or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it was designed to prevent floods. And in the new Danube, people can swim in the summer, and they do. And since the city is getting hotter year by year, it's important that people can, you know,
mm-hmm. right.
relax, like under a tree and get some fresh water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's nice. Again, that would be hard to imagine in Toledo. So one of the things you mentioned on your visit is that things in the U.S. tend to be bigger. I mean, we have bigger portions, bigger houses, bigger apartments. do you think bigger means happier, or do you think it's, you know, the Austrians are happier with smaller?
Well, most Austrians are not happy with smaller. They're trying to imitate the American lifestyle. So if you're in a village, everybody wants to have their swimming pool because they've seen movies with people doing pool parties, and no matter how small your swimming pool is, and I find it weird because you can't even swim in those pools. They're so small. Like,
mm-hmm.
Well, bigger and being better, I would say, like, of course, it's more convenient if you have a two-room apartment instead of a one-room apartment, or if you have a family, you might want to have a house where everybody has their own room, but every extra is like surplus, and you also have to pay for it, and you have a mortgage, and that's, I guess it doesn't make you happier to having to pay back a bigger mortgage, so,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know?
I guess let me rephrase the question. Are people happy even though they have small apartments, or, yeah?
I'm happy with my apartment, and yeah, well, I think that you need a certain amount of things and a certain kind of quality of life to be happy. But one of my colleagues, Vladimir Vertlip, who is a writer and a lovely person, he put it in that way, like, it makes me happy to have the money to buy one piece of cake, but doesn't necessarily make me happier to have the money to buy two pieces of cake because I maybe can't eat them both. And that's about portions, you know. It mm-hmm. doesn't make me happier to have a portion on my plate I can't finish.
Right, right. Okay. You talked about climate change and, you know, the statements of some of your ministers there. What is the political situation? Would you say most of the Austrians are accept the existence of climate change? I mean, you might have exceptions, but what's the political climate in relation to the global climate?
Well, I think they accept climate change, or at least most of them, but some say, okay, yeah, we will have also this issue, but well, let's deal with it. What's the problem? And I've read the climate book edited by Greta Thunberg, and she says it's not just climate change, it's a climate emergency, and like it won't be centimeters or decimeters of
sea level rise,
exactly. It will be meters, and it will be several meters if we melt up all the poles. And how can we deal with that? Like, we have to act, and we should act fast. And I don't see that measures from any of our political parties. In the east of Vienna, they are building a highway through the city, which separates two neighborhoods from each other. What used to be one neighborhood will be two neighborhoods divided. It will be like 5 lanes, 6 lanes. It will be noise. It will be pollution. And people will not want to live with that. And it affects their health. And it's really bad. And what they are also planning is to connect this to another road, which should build a circle around the town. And then they would dig a tunnel under one of our natural preserve areas, which is called Lobau, and it will be just, it would be bad if they succeed doing that. Mm-hmm. Current minister of transport said she won't allow this to happen, but who knows, if she's not in office, what the next one would do.
Mm. So there is opposition to it, though, and the people are fighting it.
Well, there is opposition. There's been a camp, and during the winter, people have occupied construction sites, but they were kind of violently removed by the police.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but well, let's hope the minister prevails, and they never build that.
Well, honestly, I doubt the minister prevails, because the coalition between Conservative and Green Party is that the Conservative are in the vast majority, and currently we've got the far right on the rise, and I hope, and I guess it's important, that we do everything to prevent that. And we also set more radical steps than our current Green Party is doing, and that our current Social Democrats are doing. And those are the ones who, on the one hand, build cycling lanes, on the other hand, they want to build a tunnel under our natural preserve. So, yeah.
Mm. All right. Well, so last question. What have you enjoyed about the U.S. in terms of our natural world?
Oh, I've been lucky. I've seen 2 bluebirds of happiness when I was here the last time, and I heard they're rare and they're so beautiful. And I've been to some nice trails and woods and seen deer and beautiful animals, and I've seen the Niagara Falls and been walking around a lot. And also in the cities, you find some patches of wilderness, and then you see nature is taking them over again.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that is true about Toledo.
Yeah.
It's quite a few patches like that. So, all right. Well, thanks so much, Verena. Did you want to add anything at the end, or anything you'd like to say that we didn't cover?
I would like to add about U.S. what I also like is the people, because they feel if they want something to be done, they start doing it. And that's something probably American, that you want it, you don't sit around and complain that it's not happening, but you take action. And that's what also gives me hope that situations here can be changed. And also in Europe, I think we can learn from it.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that interview. And now it's time to hear from our patrons and sponsors. For a Green Future is brought to you by our patrons. These are wonderful people who've gone to patreon.com. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. There they searched for a Green Future. up popped our wonderful Patreon page that shows different levels of memberships and has a bunch of cool photos on it. There, they picked the level of membership that matched their monthly budget, and every month, a little bit comes out of their account, comes over to us, and that's how we could afford to keep this show on the air. So we are extremely grateful to our patrons, and if you want to become one, just go to patreon.com and search for For a Green Future. Thank you.
For a Green Future is also brought to you by the Wood County Park District. The Wood County Park District is a natural resources conservation agency. They protect natural spaces, maintain quality green spaces, provide engaging programming, and they teach people to love and respect nature. They also restore wildlife habitats and lead people on outdoor adventures. Wood County Parks protects natural spaces in Wood County for all to enjoy from 8 a.m. to 30 minutes past sunset every day of the year. There are several ways to get a hold of them and find out what's happening. One is to call them at 419-353-1897. Another is to visit their website, www.wcparks.org. The website again is www.wcparks.org. They are also available on all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and many others. Just search for WC Parks. That's the Wood County Park District, and we're very grateful for their support.
Okay, so that's our patrons and sponsors, and we hope you'll support them. And we especially, once again, thank our patrons for their continued support. And so now, Rebecca, we come to your part of the show.
Yes. Okay. So on our show last week, it will be that's caught in a little bit of time warp here. Filipino mentioned something called a wood bison, which I'd never heard of that. Had you ever heard of that?
I might have heard of it, but it didn't really register. You know? Yeah.
Right. So yeah, there's a thing called bison Athabascae. Or the wood bison, or sometimes called the mountain bison, which is a northern subspecies of the American bison, or also called an ecotype. An ecotype being a genetically distinct geographic variety, population, or race within a species, which is genotypically adapted to specific environmental conditions. And what you may ask, or at least I ask, does genotypically adapted mean? Genotype is the sum total of genes transferred from parents to offspring, or the complete set of heritable genes that can be transferred to offspring from parents. So it's just an organism of genes. It's a collection of genes, basically. But so what they're saying, genotypically adapted means that their collection of genes is adapted to the specific environmental conditions of that area, which is why they're an ecotype. Alrighty then.
As opposed to phenotype, which is the expression of those genes.
Exactly. Which phenotype is stuff you can actually see. But yeah, their range is the boreal forests of region of Alaska, the Yukon, Western Northwest Territories, Northeastern British Columbia, North Alberta, and Saskatchewan, mostly in Canada at this point. Conservation status is vulnerable, and they're in the bovid family, meaning they're not a true buffalo. This is true of regular plains buffaloes too. They're not true buffalo in the sense of being related to the Asian water buffalo. But both bison and buffalo have the same colloquial meaning of ox or bullock. So you're sort of wrong if you call it a buffalo, but not that much. Probably not enough to worry about it. And as Joseph, phenotype is they're also a phenotype, meaning they look different from regular buffalo. Phenotype being a set of observable characteristics of an individual resulting from the interaction of its genotype and environment. So yada yada, they're bigger and heavier. I did not know this. I assumed they'd be smaller. Joe, we were thinking about it in the car. It's like, well, they have to fit between trees. Of course they'd be smaller. But no, they're bigger. Bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah, it's hard to imagine a bigger bison. I mean,
yeah,
when you see the Yellowstone bison and stuff, and I know you kind of have a guilty pleasure of watching like bison tossing.
Yes, I do.
Bison tossing tourist videos.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine even bigger bison.
It's a popular bar sport among buffalo and tourist tossing. Yeah, but when I was out in Wyoming, when I had a friend going to grad school there, there's a Museum of Natural History in at the University of Wyoming, which is actually very cool. It's a cool little museum. It's small, but it's got a lot of stuff in it. And it says that the prehistoric bison used to be really, really big, like, you know, kind of halfway, almost elephant size big.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Extremely big.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like maybe small elephants. I don't know. It's halfway between a rhinoceros and an elephant.
Like Indian elephant level, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You really just wanted to stay out of their way.
Yeah. Well, and Philip mentioned the wood bison, like there might have been some in the eastern forest, too.
Right, right.
And my experience with native people is that when the Western scientific opinion is something mm-hmm. and the native, like, oral history says something else, usually in the end, the native oral history turns out to be right.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we've seen that with how long Native Americans have been here, you know, right. For decades, almost more than a century. It was the scientific idea was, like 10,000 years, you know. But we've been finding fossils and footprints and bones that show, you know,
nope.
much longer, yep. much more than 10,000 years. And so, which tied in with what the natives themselves were saying.
Is what, was it some kind of footprints in Death Valley or something? I forget.
Yeah, they just found some footprints in Death Valley.
Yeah, I read these archaeology articles, but not everything necessarily sticks.
I think those were like 40,000 years old.
Right.
So
a little more than 10,000.
So the scientists were wrong. And I also heard that the Europeans are the ones who brought dogs to the to North America. But then I heard from Native American people who said, we had dogs.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? And just recently I read that there is a Native North American breed of dogs that was domesticated by the Native Americans, you know. So,
right.
So when Philip was suggesting there were those wood bison were even around here.
Yeah.
I tend to believe him.
Eventually the scientists might figure out that they were. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Well, great. On to ecological news. And we've got an interesting bunch of ecological news this week. First story, we go to, unfortunately, we have to go back to Fukushima, where they
more Fukushima.
Yeah, where they just released their third batch of radioactive water. The IAEA, of course, approves heartily. They think it's the most wonderful thing in the world that Fukushima is dumping radiation into the Pacific. Other people and organizations, like there's a scientist named Paul Dorfman, and he's like, no, whatever you put radiation into the ecosystems, eventually it's going to find its way into living things. And the fact that they're planning to do this essentially forever, because the plant is still reacting, you know, it's still creating new radioactive waste every single day. So
it just occurred to me that actually Fukushima would make a good cuss word. Like, oh, Fukushima. Yeah, because it sounds, you know, like a cuss word in English. Plus, it really is something very, very bad.
Yeah, it's really
it's a
terrible.
Big disaster, you know.
Good point. Yeah, that might be our new official
right.
cuss word here on
Fukushima.
For a Green Future. Yeah,
there
it's
we
like,
go.
Oh, Fukushima. Right. So
like when something doesn't record or something, you know, that we spent 45
minutes
on.
Like I forget to push a button like I did this morning, and I don't have a video of the interview with Verena, but okay. On to our next story. Electric vehicle sales continue to grow. This is a bulletin put out by the Union of Concerned Scientists on November 13th. And what's been happening is there have been a lot of, just recently, like in the past 2 months, a lot of stories in the media saying, oh, electric car sales aren't going nearly as well as they're supposed to be. They're not meeting projections, blah, 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 blah. But what they're pointing out here in the UNCERN scientists is that they're still growing by leaps and bounds. In the third quarter of this year, there are more than 300,000 either electric or plug-in hybrid electric vehicles sold in the U.S., and that's a 50% increase over the third quarter 1 year ago.
I remember when my mom was getting her MBA in business, she had this one professor who had some kind of an accent, and he kept talking about corporate yearnings.
Okay.
The corporate yearnings were
corporate
strong
yearnings.
This year.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
That's corporations for you. They have a lot of yearnings for things.
Yeah, unhealthy yearnings a lot
indeed,
of times.
Yes.
Yeah. So, so this means that right now, nationwide, 8% of car sales are electric or plug-in hybrid, which is great, you know. And actually, that number is 25% in California. So even though here in Ohio we penalize people who buy electric cars, but it is important to note that at least for the next couple of years, that penalty is more than offset by the tax credits you can get
Excellent.
From the federal government. So
Okey-doke.
Don't let the $100 fine by Ohio keep you from buying a plug-in hybrid, because you'll get more than 10 times that much back from the federal government.
It's just Ohio getting a few more drops from the government teat, but you'll be all right.
Yeah. So don't let that stop you from buying an electric car. And we had an electric car in Bowling Green's holiday parade this week. And in fact, Ursula was in that car, our lovely dog. And
I was just giving a belly rub too.
Yes. If you watch on video, if there's a advantage to watching on our show on video, because you get to see Ursula.
Right, yeah. They don't allow her in the studio.
No, they
for some reason.
Won't let us bring dogs into the studio. But and so it was great. We were just cruising along, all electric, no exhaust, perfectly quiet. It was, you know, it was cool. All right, next story. NPR on November 17th did a report on the fact that the USDA has updated its plant hardiness zone map. And so what all this means is something that we already reported this year, how our frost was 3 weeks later than average. Well, the USDA has bumped about half the country up into warmer planting zones.
Yep.
Which means now you can grow stuff way farther north than you used to be able to.
Tropical Ohio.
Right. And it also means that on average, the U.S., they're saying, is 2.5 degrees warmer than in 2012. So now some people think this is a great thing. In fact, there was a guy who spoke at Bowling Green City Council last night who was on his way to suggesting that you know, global warming is good because it'll mean we can grow more.
Well, if it just would stop now, it probably would sort of semi-okay. You know, there'd be a few more hurricanes and some islands underwater, but, you know.
Well, the big problem.
But it won't, because it feeds on itself.
Yeah, it's just the positive feedback.
Yeah.
And the big problem with warmer is also drier.
Yeah, true.
And water actually evaporates more quickly in a higher CO2 atmosphere.
Wow.
So not only does it rain harder when it does rain, but then that rain evaporates quicker, so it does even less to help the crops.
Oh my gosh, wow.
So the disadvantages definitely outweigh any advantages. And so, you know, it's kind of insane to suggest we should just keep putting carbon in the air, because then our corn will be taller. No, that doesn't make any sense. In fact, they're trying to genetically modify corn now to be shorter, because when you get lots of tornadoes and windstorms and things, having tall plants is kind of problematic.
That seems, you know, as a lifetime Midwesterner, you see some nice tall corn, you get a happy feeling, you know?
Yeah.
it's just a thing. You got cousins who farm, you're like, yeah, tall corn.
And you don't, there's something called iatrogenic in the hospitals. It's like when the treatments reach the point where they're causing as many problems as the disease you originally got in there for.
Yep.
Yeah. And the more we try to do this kind of thing, the more we try to like genetically modify corn so that it's not tall enough to be blown over by winds. I mean, there's at some point you run into problems from your solutions, and at some point things just like collapse. So
yep,
let's just stop putting carbon in the air. Let's okay.
Knee high by the 4th of July.
Here, here. So next, interesting story from the Ukraine. As we know from history, whenever there's a nuclear disaster like Chernobyl, like Fukushima, like Three Mile Island, the powers that be are completely useless in terms of telling us what's going on. In fact, one of the most telling things in the entire Fukushima disaster was that when the cloud of radiation from Japan reached the United States, all the radiation air monitors happened to be turned off.
Oh, well, how did that happen?
Well, it was maintenance.
Right. Mystery, yeah.
Right. And then later, Obama made the woman who was in charge of that maintenance head of the EPA.
Huh.
So she
okay.
got a nice little promotion yeah. out of that whole fiasco. But we ended up with no data. We couldn't say, oh, you know, here in Sacramento, you've got 50 times the background radiation. Stay inside. No,
right.
So everybody was outside playing
oh, great.
In the whatever. So, and we can't define the whatever because they turned off all the monitors.
Right.
So what Greenpeace has done with the cooperation of the Ukrainian government is they have installed a network, a nationwide network of radiation monitors.
Eh, not too shabby.
Yeah, and I do trust Greenpeace on this kind of thing. And the reason, of course, is the IAEA is not going to tell us anything,
right?
You know, if there's a disaster. And there's lots of potentials for disaster because every one of Ukraine's nuke plants is just a Russian missile strike away from another meltdown.
Oh, boy.
So it's a really extensive network, and it's great. And I have tried to use, like, if you buy a Geiger counter privately, often that'll be linked to a private network of other people who have the Geiger counters from the same companies.
Mm-hmm.
But those aren't reliable because people don't turn their monitors on.
Right.
You know, and I've had situations where I suspected there was some kind of nuclear problem somewhere, and one monitor would say, oh yeah, the radiation levels are way high, but then the one right next to it would say zero, you know, nothing. Nothing's out of the ordinary. So I couldn't report on it. I couldn't confirm it. This one, there's so many Geiger counters on this, so many radiation monitors in this network that you can double check them against each other.
Wow.
And you can actually watch waves of radiation as they cross the country. And anyone can do it. It's an open source thing. It's on the internet. You just go to Save Ecobot. That's SaveEcobot.com. And one of the interesting things, one of the ways you kind of know this is working is if you look at Pripyat, the city, the abandoned city of Pripyat, which is right next to Chernobyl. I looked at it this morning, and the count there of nanosieverts per hour, the count is 7,380. Which normal background radiation in most of Ukraine is about 100. So this is 73 times background radiation.
Oopsie doodle.
Which, you know, it's kind of good this is an abandoned city.
Yeah.
Because if people were living in that, they would, well, they would probably not be living in that for very long.
Right.
And so it also might make one, if any of you are thinking of going there for like, disaster tourism, you might want to think again. but it bears watching. And so now if there are radiation releases, like there's been accusations that one of the Ukraine's munitions depot that had depleted uranium in them was blown up and caused a radiological incident. But that hasn't been confirmed by anybody, and it's certainly not going to be confirmed by, you know, the Ukraine's not going to admit if that happened.
Probably not.
But some people claim it did. A fellow, the doctor who's been on the show before, named Chris Busby, says he's got documentation for it. But this documentation from Greenpeace, if that happens again, we should all be able to just watch
it. At least we'll know. Cloud. Okay. Yeah.
So not operating in the dark. And our final story, we're going to Finland. Lovely Finland, where this past April, they finally turned on the Olkiluoto nuclear reactor. We've talked about that in the past. Largest nuclear reactor in Europe, 1.6 gigawatts. And it was 14 years late and many, many billions of dollars over budget. But they,
as they usually are.
As they usually are. But the Finnish government has been like, oh, it's the most wonderful thing ever. Yeah, right. But what happened just 2 days ago, it crashed.
Oopsie.
The turbines failed. 1.3 gigawatts just dropped out of the Finnish electrical grid, and immediately you had to fire up the coal plants, fire up the gas plants to make up, or the grid would have crashed. And so this actually has the Finns kind of worried, because
I'd be worried too.
It's the start of winter.
Oh, right, yeah.
And they were counting on that 1.3 gigawatts for 15% of the country's power. And if they can't get it back up and running, Finland is going to be in major difficulty this winter, because, you know, the other sources of energy that they use. Now, this nuclear plant kind of suppressed. They were going gangbusters on wind power, because they've got a lot of wind power, and they were going pretty good on solar. But once they got this monster onto their grid, they're like, oh, we don't need to really focus on those anymore, do we? We got, look at all this carbon-free power. And now all that carbon-free power is just, you know, sitting there doing nothing. And turbine difficulties of this kind can take months to repair.
Oh,
so
okay.
They may be without this power for the whole of winter.
And, oh, my.
Yeah. And so that's just a cautionary tale, whereas if they had thousands of widely distributed solar panels and wind turbines and battery storage, the failure of any one of them wouldn't affect the whole grid. You know, that's the fundamental principle of decentralization. So
keep warm, Finland.
So, yeah, tough luck, Finland. But, you know, you really have only yourselves to blame. So, all right. Well, I think that's it for this show, our 251st episode of For a Green Future.
Wahoo!
We hope you enjoyed it. Rebecca and I will be back next week, hopefully maybe in studio. But until then, this is Joe DeMar.
And Rebecca Wood.
And we are signing off.
I don't want no oil. A spoil in my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes! No.